consideration. Andrew is going to give us a presentation.
Thank you very much indeed, Hans, and thanks for the opportunity to present this here. I'm sure you've all read the paper, and the objective really of this afternoon is not for you to listen to me, but for me to listen to you. And therefore I will try to be brief in teeing it up, which I'll do by reference to slides. The first slide says that the views expressed are personal, which is a standard disclaimer. It's almost unnecessary because I'm not sure I'm going to express any views because we're at a very early stage. So, why did we decide to do some work on variable and contingent consideration? Really, because it seems to crop up quite frequently in standard setting. Various standards set out some principles which, on the whole, are uncontroversial, but it's not quite clear what those requirements are based on in terms of principle, and therefore whether they are consistent, and therefore whether they would provide a guide to future standard setting. That prompts the thought that this is perhaps unusual in the sense that it seems to me the benefit of doing this would largely be for standard setting and therefore sort of for ourselves and the kind of people that are represented in the room. I don't think it's the kind of project where our stakeholders, be they investors or preparers, are going to get terribly excited. Another reason for undertaking it now is that we now have a new conceptual framework which seems to contain a number of interesting thoughts that might be helpful in this. And indeed, we thought it would be helpful to IASB, given that it's been identified as a project on IASB's research pipeline. So that was sort of why we decided to do it. Having made that decision, we began to realise how complicated it was. And so we've rather restricted the scope of what we're looking at today. We're only looking at accounting by the purchaser under a transaction in which there's probably a fixed amount paid, although perhaps not necessarily. The amount that will ultimately be paid depends on future events of various kinds. We also think the project should not address the time value of money. If the consideration, at least in part, depends on future events, it more or less follows inevitably it will be deferred, and so the issue of discounting comes to mind and probably would be required in practice. However, we think it would just obscure any discussion of examples, and people would, it just makes it much harder to follow. So we can either say we are excluding the time value of money, or we're assuming an environment in which interest rates are zero. We're also looking at what we've called transactions on market terms. Sometimes different words are used to get the same flavour, arm's length transactions, transactions that are not that are exchanges of equal value and so on, and that's the kind of idea we're hinting at there. We don't mean by that that the assets and liabilities would all qualify for level one measurement under IFRS 13 or anything like that. We just mean they're basically arm's length transactions. However, we have to recognise, and we'll perhaps get down to this later, that the two parts of the transactions may be interdependent. In other words, you may agree to a high fixed price in return for a lower variable amount, or vice versa. So they don't necessarily reflect the value of what each seems to transfer. And we've also said that we're looking at transactions only where the consideration is payable in cash. That's because it saves writing to have to say every time, you know, the purchaser agrees to transfer cash or another asset embodying economic benefits. It all gets a bit wordy. I don't think that's a terribly important restriction. The issues that we identify in the paper as arising is, when you have one of these transactions, what exactly is the asset that the purchaser gets? What liabilities are assumed? And then we've got to consider, do they meet the recognition criteria? The next set of issues arises on subsequent remeasurement, and that is all about, well, when the amount of the liability changes, does that change the carrying amount of the asset? And we are fairly clear, I hope, that we don't think we're going to answer all of these questions in the same way for every transaction that involves variable and contingent consideration. the answers will vary depending on circumstances. What are those circumstances and what are the underlying principles is what we hope eventually, but not in this paper, to clarify. Slide 5 just reminds you that one of the achievements of the new conceptual framework is to clarify that essentially assets are rights, not lumps of property or indeed single contracts. And in particular, it highlights that an asset might be some sort of share in an asset. That's something which is now perhaps familiar to more than it used to be, given the advent of IFRS 15 on leases. But as I've discussed this issue around, it's slightly surprising how many people haven't really internalised that thought and still think that assets are naturally identified with such things as physical items of property. So, when you buy an asset, when you enter into a transaction involving variable and contingent consideration, there seem to be two possible attitudes. One is that you've bought the entire thing, which implies that if you've paid the fixed consideration, you then have a liability for the variable and contingent consideration. Or you can say, well, I've only bought part of the asset and I don't have any liability, but there might be other rights or obligations floating around. We give three examples in the paper. We tried to write a paper without any examples, but it proved too difficult. One of them is a transaction in foreign currency, where if the variation, part of the consideration is deferred, then clearly the amount you're going to have to pay in functional currency is subject to variation as exchange rates fluctuate. I don't think there's much doubt that the existing requirement to record the transaction at the spot rate at the time of the transaction is anything other than the right answer. And you've bought the entire asset. The asset you have is indistinguishable from that which would be acquired if the transaction had been incurred in your functional currency. Slightly more colourfully, we look at the idea of buying a racehorse. Under a transaction in which the fixed amount is paid, but the purchaser agrees to give a proportion of future winnings on one particular race to the seller. We note that in such a case it would seem necessary for the contract to impose other conditions, such as don't change the training arrangements, don't withdraw from the race on which the share depends, and so on and so forth. And there you could conclude that, well, you've bought an entire racehorse, its fair value must be the value of what you've paid and the value of the possible future prize winnings, so you should book both the asset and the liability, perhaps. And the third example we give is that of a publisher that pays a fixed amount to publish a certain numbers of a novel, but also agrees that if he or she decides to publish anything above that certain quantum, then an additional royalty will be paid. But it's hard to consider assets without considering liabilities, and slide 7 is a condensed version of what the framework says on liabilities. It sets out 4 conditions. One is there must be an obligation. The third is that obligation must be one to transfer an economic resource. Those two don't seem to be terribly tricky, in my view. But what is trickier is there is no practical ability to avoid the obligation, and that obligation must come about as a result of past events, which means that you've taken an action or obtained economic benefits, and the obligation is a result of that past event. And it's important that you have to satisfy all 4 conditions. One of the other observations of the framework, which I set out in slide 8, is that you might have the ability to avoid something, an obligation, such as such as withdrawing from a particular line of business or whatever, and that speaks to the practical ability to avoid a condition. And it also says, and this I think is one that people often neglect, is that just because a future outflow of cash is highly probable, it doesn't follow that it is a liability. Some would say you meet the past event test because you've signed a contract and it's something that stems from the contract, but that's part of the issues that we need to explore. But just because we've identified the assets and liabilities doesn't mean that we know the answers. We've still got to address recognition. And the framework says that you recognise assets and liabilities when you can provide a faithful representation, not only of the assets and liabilities, but of also any income and expenses or changes in equity. Interestingly, it says that you might not recognise that initial recognition of a transactional market terms doesn't usually give rise to income or expense. And it does say that you might not recognise an asset or a liability if it gives rise to some kind of an accounting mismatch. But it is totally clear that you never recognise something that doesn't meet the definition of an element. Now, that might be an area where I'm reading the framework more carefully than it was intended to be read, but I can think that's the sense that I take from it. It also says that measurement uncertainty may prevent you recognising something. I think that could be a factor in many variable and contingent consideration transactions. If you think about the publisher example, well, who knows whether the additional consideration that he pays if he gets into that phase of the contract, who knows whether that's a valuable option, in other words, an asset, or not. Then after initial recognition, we get on to the issues relating to changes in the liability. There seem to be two views that are possible. One is that if the liability goes up or indeed down, I always find that it's easier to think of liabilities going up somehow, then that change should result in an adjustment to the cost of the asset, or it might result in income or expense of the period. So, for example, if we have the IFRIC, I think it's IFRIC 1, but I sometimes say IFRIC 4 by mistake, decommissioning liabilities, it kind of says if you're drilling an oil well and you initially incur the decommissioning liability and capitalise it as part of the cost, and when that liability increases, so does the carrying amount of your oil well. And not everybody would agree that that is necessarily the right answer in all circumstances, I would think. And there seem to be two underlying views, and I think part of the problem is that we're not very clear as to what cost is. Some people think that when you initially recognise the oil well, you put it in at your best guess of what the cost would be, and if later on you find that cost is something different, then you're perfectly entitled to say, well, hold on, here's a change in estimate, we'll change the amount of the liability, we'll change the amount of the asset. Others note that the conceptual framework now fairly wisely observes that one of the reasons why historical cost seems to make sense is that if you've just gone out and bought something, it seems reasonable to assume that you're going to get economic benefits that are at least as great as the cost that you've incurred. Now, in a case of variable and contingent consideration, if the amount that you're going to have to pay exceeds what you ever thought you were likely to pay, then that rationale would not hold. And so there's a possible conclusion that increasing the amount of the asset by that amount would not be justifiable. So I reach slide 13, where I suggest three questions that I think would be very helpful if ASAF would discuss. The first is, could be summarised perhaps unkindly, as should we stop now and do no further work on the subject, because it's all too difficult. Second one is, have we correctly analysed it as far as we've got? What should we consider going forward? What have we missed? And the third is, how should we best take this project forward?
Thank you. We think the FRC's research to explore the principle of the transaction involving variable and contingent consideration is very timely and meaningful, especially because key value driver of entity is shifting to intangible, so that there will be the more transaction involving intangible, and due to the inherent uncertainty of intangible value, there will be more transaction involving the variable and contingent consideration. So in that context, this research is very meaningful. And even so, following the analysis of FRC, we got an impression that it contains various components all at once. And we think a different principle could be considered depending on the type of asset acquired. For example, whether it is a tangible or intangible, or it is leased asset. And second, type of compensation, whether it is the variable or the contingent. And finally, the form of payment. For example, it would be the proportionate payment or the lump sum payment. All these kind of the components are commingled in the analysis. So we think it would be good to start from the very simplest and the symbolic transaction, and we think about the principle, which principle should be applied in that simplest and the symbolic transaction, and next move to the some expanded set of the example. I think it would be good to consider.
Thank you very much.
Roger.
First of all, I congratulate FRC for bringing out very pertinent issue as regards to variable and contingent consideration, and it has its own merits. I am representing the view on behalf of the AOSSG. The AOSSG members, in particular China, Australia, Korea, has given a lot of inputs and comments, and the Malaysia has also commented on the issue. To go in particular, with reference to question number one, currently there is an inconsistency in practice on account of variable future payments. And therefore, we agree to explore further on the matter of issue on conceptual basis. IFRS, to some extent, specify accounting treatment. However, there is a need to sort out these requirements, try to find out the inconsistency, improve upon the general accounting principles within the conceptual framework, and try to give the additional guidance based on the conceptual framework. Limited guidance is available. Limited guidance is to be developed on variable and contingent consideration, in particular with reference to PPE. Now, FRC result on the project may not necessarily lead to the revision of existing standard, but it will provide a conceptual background when IASB will make the new standards, and that is very important to note. So, in general, as far as question number one is concerned, the AOSSG members agree in unanimity that the matter is to be taken further. With reference to question number two, that is, analysis presented and the scope of the project. There is an agreement in general that we have to go further with reference to the analysis. And the request of the AOSSG members to consider the additional issues as Let us decide the limitation or the scope of the project. Try to analyze different situations based on conceptual framework with reference to even case studies from different industries. The examples given are not enough to understand the issue in totality. Try to find out differences in initial recognition and measurement, especially amount of assets and liabilities. One of the very basic issues raised by Australia is what is the difference between variable and contingent consideration. If I give the example of a contingent consideration, the members can just consider. If there is a turnkey project of building and there is one clause in the agreement that 5% amount is retained subject to that there is no leakage at least for one rainy season. Now in this particular case, the accounting will be done with totality because amount certainty is there. But what is the contingent issue? There may be leakage and there may not be a leakage. Now this is a contingent consideration or not. I just request the members to view. As against this contingent consideration, if we talk about variable consideration, take example of a turnkey project of a sugar plant, and the value of the project depends upon output performance. Brazil will agree with me, in case of a sugar cane, if you put 100 kg sugar cane for crushing, you may get sugar output of either 10 kg, 10.25 kg, 10.50 kg. And the supplier has put an agreement. In case of the minimum, this is a fixed consideration. But in case, if at least in one season, on an average, if the output performance is 10.25, additional amount of this much is payable. If further performance changes, further consideration will be payable. Now that will be variable consideration. But rightly brought out by FRC, that how to determine and measure that variable consideration is very difficult to begin with, because there may or may not be that performance possible. So in this variable consideration, the additional consideration or variable consideration might have not accounted for. But in case of the contingent consideration, in the example I have given of retention, you will account for and show as a liability. That is a normal practice in at least EOSSG jurisdictions. So what is the variable and contingent consideration difference, and whether the accounting treatment will differ in case of the variable and in case of the contingent consideration? That we'll have to talk about. Now, this consideration has a linkage over the life of the asset. There are two possibilities are there. Either it is on the full life of the asset, or there may be the additional output only in a some period of future. In this case, how to consider? In case, if we arrive at conclusion, or ISB arrive at finally conclusion, that this is to be capitalized and not to be shown as an expense, or this is to be decrease the value of the asset and show as income. But in case it is to be capitalized, how to provide depreciation? Whether depreciation on PPE is to be provided retrospectively or to be provided prospectively over the balance life of the asset, of course subject to impairment of the asset. That we'll have to consider. Now this contingent consideration may be during earn-out period, which may be extra economic benefit only in a particular period. Then in that case, can we arrive at a conclusion that whether there is an indication that the value of the asset of the life is expected to be higher as compared to originally anticipated? So now one issue has been raised by FRC, whether there is a liability initially, and that is one of the very crucial issues to be considered, that initially what market value only will be recorded, which is minimum or the fixed, and the variable will not be recognized. Actually, that is the issue they have raised, and it has to take further research. Now, whether there is a present obligation, very right apt issue they have brought out, that whether it is at the time of signing the agreement or it is at the time of occurring of a particular event whereby the consideration gets changed. Though FRC said about purchaser's perspective, research can include the seller's perspective also. Of course, there is a guidance available in IFRS 15, but still the comparison and cross-checking can be done if the research goes further. But we feel, actually, in particular the Australia, they are talking about whether mirror accounting is necessary. That question is there. In whatever the accounting treatment in the books of a seller you have given, whether accounting entries are also correspondingly required in the books of purchaser. It is felt that Korea has specifically given a suggestion that rather than conceptual framework, we have to go to the standard level requirement as far as this issue is concerned. And probably the standards which may affect are IFRS 3, 16, 37, 38, even IAS 2 also as regards to inventory. That is with reference to question number 2. And the question number 3, how the project will be best taken forward further. For this purpose, the suggestions are sort out the requirement in specific IFRS and find out the inconsistency and degree of inconsistency. That is number 1. Number 2, perform the research as well as outreach in different industries, in different situations, in different jurisdictions. Assess the impact of general principles mentioned in the project. And they have rightly stated, and we agree, that in case if the impact is significant, then move to the standard setting project. And in case if it is insignificant, it will be supplementary to the conceptual framework. Even the suggestion from Australia is, this project should be taken further by IASB and closely linked with conceptual framework for financial reporting. Thank you.
Thank you. Noble?
Yes, thank you. We agree that this issue is worth exploring, and we'd like to commend Andrew and the FRC for this, developing this paper. When we read the paper and the presentation, we find that there are several views on how to look at this purchase, whether it's two transactions or one transaction with two components, and I think that suggests that we need discussions on the unit of account. And I think the new conceptual framework of the ISB has some reference to the unit of account, and if you can link the discussions with those paragraphs, I think that you might have a better document that you have. So that would be a suggestion.
Tim?
Likewise, I think it's an issue worth exploring. I had, in terms of question 2, maybe a number of questions that might be helpful to also sort through in terms of its the depth of scope, including whether it would just be arrangements where there's additional consideration, or whether it's also inclusive of arrangements where consideration would be returned. So take the horse, for example. You could structure the same arrangement where I make a fixed payment up front and there is a return of consideration if the horse fails to place in the top 3. That one makes the views a little more challenging, because there you could argue you've acquired the whole horse and have to give back rights. And you would presumably hate to see different accounting depending on whether the arrangements were structured for a payment with a return versus a fixed payment with an additional. But I think it does make the analysis harder when it's return rights. And then you have to think about maybe the corollary to 15, where variable and contingent consideration includes rights. So that's the seller side, but obviously the counterparty to that transaction would be the purchaser. So is everything that would be viewed as variable consideration in 15, if you were the purchaser, would that be variable consideration? And there's a lot of different types of payments that people might start feeling uncomfortable with. Return rights suddenly are variable consideration, which might be in the scope of this. So that was one. And then the second is I wondered if it's even possible to address entirely in isolation. And you talk about unit of account, but that, to me, when you get into intangibles, quickly gets into whether something is an executory contract as well or not. If you take just a license of intellectual property, say music rights, where you're going to pay a variable amount per usage, you could argue you've acquired those rights and the consideration is variable, or you could argue that that is an executory contract. Made more difficult if you make a fixed payment up front plus some variability. And so I don't know if you can address it entirely without getting into when is the purchase of an intangible the actual purchase versus an executory contract. This puts that front and center. That might be as challenging of issue as just the variable consideration. But I'm not sure you can deal with one without the other if you're going to start splitting rights on tangible assets. It certainly comes up much more dividable when it's intangible. But I think a useful discussion, and to me the best approach going forward is to think about would it be some addition to concepts versus thinking about it first at the standards, maybe the standards level. And then the last, forgot on the prior question, the last piece I did have a question on is it purchases of all assets, including if you viewed the purchase of employee services as the purchase of an asset that's immediately consumed, the scope of this would then also include things like pensions, share remuneration if it were paid in share-based remuneration if it were paid in cash, so that the scope could become quite expansive if you thought about everything that you purchased that had variability.
Sure. Andrew?
So I agree with a lot of what Jim was saying in terms of the variable consideration piece. On the contingent consideration piece, what I'm happy to share with you is that our IFRS discussion group in Canada has had several discussions on the accounting for contingent consideration on asset purchases throughout the years. There's actually been three separate discussions. And the fun part always with the committee is that there was actually no distinct view. It was, some thought measured at fair value, some thought, recorded at some other point, some thought it was a policy choice, some just thought it was unclear. But what they could all agree on was that at a high level, it's facts and circumstances specific, and that judgment would be required. I think what that kind of all took me to, and when I was listening to a lot of the discussion that's been happening around the table, was, when we're considering the notion of contingent consideration, is it a symptom of something bigger in that there's an issue with IAS 37 in that contingencies in and of itself, and can we deal with contingent considerations in isolation of dealing with contingencies, which may be somewhat of what Jim was talking to when he was saying considering other standards kind of idea, but that kind of was something that came to mind when I was thinking about that, which could potentially throw a wrench in your plan in terms of moving forward. Mm. And I'm cognizant of that. I apologize for that in advance. But that's some of the thoughts that we were having in terms of that piece.
Thank you, Alexander?
First of all, I think you are absolutely right on getting this discussion of variable consideration in terms of definitions of assets and liabilities and get some more fundamental concepts here. I loved your Pegasus example, and let's just assume that if Pegasus is not involved in this arrangement, the fair value of Pegasus is 100. And let's assume that you end up buying Pegasus in this example here. With these arrangements, you're not going to pay 100. You're going to pay 80, for example. So there is a 20 difference here. And let's assume that Pegasus lose the next race. So by something that has nothing to do, it's not Pegasus' fault. You know what I mean, it's raining and Pegasus doesn't like to run on raining. Obviously, now the fair value of Pegasus become 100 again.
Yep.
So it's clearly. Have three situations here, a situation of 100, a situation of 80, that becomes 100 after. So I think you're absolutely right. You have to adjust the value of the asset, otherwise you're going to have a fake representation, because if someone else bought a Pegasus without this arrangement, going to have a 100. Yeah. Now I got a Pegasus with this arrangement, but the arrangement had dissipated already. I need to have 100 in my books. So a strong support for that. I think is a valid conceptual question here.
Peter.
Thanks. A few points. First of all, I think it's a really excellent paper, very concise but very clear. And what I particularly liked, not surprisingly, was that it's a very good analysis of how you'd apply the conceptual framework to this. So well done, Andrew, and let's encourage everybody else to do the same. There's an interesting question, I think, that came up in Shivaji's comments about mirror accounting. One thing we put in the framework was a statement that for every liability, there's an asset on somebody else's books, theoretically. Although it doesn't necessarily follow that every asset has a liability on somebody's books, because not all assets are of that kind. And I think it can sometimes be helpful to think about it from the counterparty side, even if you're not necessarily going to end up literally with mirror accounting for all kinds of reasons. But I think just thinking through what are the rights and obligations, it can be very useful to think about both sides of the transactions. I started doing that for the publisher example and didn't really get to a conclusion. So that's my piece of homework, is to go away and think about that one a bit more. You've collected some items from the liabilities part of the framework and also from IS 37. One thing that struck me, you mentioned the infamous smoke filter example in IS 37. And I think one thing we tried to clarify in the framework is that when people are looking at whether you can avoid a transfer, it's important not just to look at the cash side of the transaction, but also to look at whether you receive something else in exchange. So I think the way the conceptual framework team analyzed the smoke filter example is, yes, you can't avoid fitting this smoke filter because the law says you have to. But when you pay the cash, you're going to receive something in exchange, which is you're going to receive the smoke filter. Your factory may then be impaired. That's a separate question. But it's an obligation to exchange. It's not an obligation just to pay a cash amount, and that's probably quite an important piece of it. I think one of the really important questions is this question of what asset did you receive? And you mentioned the conditions for does a liability exist. One of them is looking at what benefit you've received. And for a lot of these, I think it's really critical to establish exactly what asset you've received. Is it the full asset? Is it a portion of the asset? Is it the asset plus some type of option? I'd just like to remind you that we explored at World Standard Setters, I think it was last year, some examples based on the conceptual framework, which was designed to explore that. We had an example, I can't remember the details now, but that was exploring this question of whether the asset you've received is a single asset or is it a combination of an asset and an option. And certainly in the breakout that I was in, and I think from what I heard from most of the others, there was actually very little appetite for seeing it as a combination of an asset and another option.
Yeah.
But I think that's a topic that may be worth exploring further. Finally, I just wanted to mention where this fits in on our agenda as well. As Andrew mentioned, there's a project on variable and contingent consideration in our research pipeline at the moment, so it's not an active project. I'm not sure at this stage exactly when we're going to start up. It's certainly not going to be next week or next month even necessarily. But I did want to remind you as well that when the board put that into the pipeline, it did also say that there might need to be some follow-up work on risk-sharing arrangements, which also seems to be quite closely linked to this question.
I just wanted to add something very quick that I thought of, having read your paper and also considered what Peter said and what Jim said, that I wonder if your starting point, as you say, you're trying to get the benefits received that have created this obligation to pay. And the starting point could be, as Peter says, to define really carefully what asset you've received, what is the right you've received. And I just wondered whether what you need to try and identify is is your right of use that has been delivered to you already? What right of use has already been delivered? And then the variability could be that there is uncertainty over the right of use, and that could be because of the performance condition, of the performance uncertainty that you were talking about. So that could be one reason for the variability. The second reason could be that it's very clear what right of use you have, but it's not clear what the value is of that right of use. So with the publisher, you've got unlimited rights to publish the book, but you don't know how many copies will be bought, so you don't know the value of that right of use. So for some reason, you're sharing the risk.
Yeah.
And then the third one could be that part of what you've received isn't, and this is Peter's option, I think, isn't a right of use that has already been delivered. It's an option to draw down a further right of use.
Yeah.
And an indication of that might be that if you don't draw it down, the publisher keeps it. And this is where you start thinking about it from the counterparty again. Has the counterparty kept any rights? Or might you be returning any rights to get back to the notion of return versus drawdown? They're the same thing from different perspectives. And if so, in your publisher's example, suppose you had you got the right to print 100,000 copies, and then if you decide to print more, you pay more. It could depend on whether you're the only person who's got the right to decide to pay print more, or whether if you don't print more, the other party, the seller, retains a right to print the extra ones itself, so that there is some sort of right of use that you haven't drawn down yet. So that was just a few more thoughts.
Thanks, Jim. Shivaji?
I'm just with reference to the two examples a little bit. As far as I may be wrong, we can just issue for thought. In case of the Pegasus, you pay, say, 1,000 and debit to an asset account. And can I say there is an uncertainty as far as prize winning is concerned in the next derby? Can I say like this, that 60% amount is payable by the purchaser to the seller, subject to the horse wins? If horse wins, can I say that 60% consideration I have to pay, 100% I have to receive? You can say that is from seller's perspective, but from purchaser's perspective point of view, purchaser's perspective, I will receive the 100 and I have to pay 60. So can I say my income itself is 40, rather than thinking of capitalization of further amount of 60%. Why I'm saying like this? Whenever I purchase the new asset, many time, to begin with, my capacity utilization may not be 100%. And then in that case, my income is lesser. So whether in an example of Pegasus, whether the adjustment is required to an asset account or whether the adjustment is required to income account, that is one. Now, in case of the publishing right, you have stated that up to 5,000 copies, CU 5,000 is payable, and for additional copy, CU 1 per copy is there. Again, in this also, can I think like this, that whatever initially I paid the fixed sum of 5,000 is my consideration for right to use copyright, and whatever the additional CU1 is payable per copy is like a royalty, which is a revenue expenditure. So again, rather than adjustment to the asset account, can we adjust to the royalty account? However, you have given the example of CU70 fixed and 30 variable. There is a consideration and needs whatever the members are deliberating on the issue.
Any other comments? Okay, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone for those interesting comments.
At least your the first answer was not that you could stop working. Okay, well, we are a bit early, but we'll resume our meeting tomorrow morning.